Chapter 9. A man who has built up a vast business, starting from nothing, must, of necessity, be a man capable of making swift decisions. And until this moment, Lord Tilbury had never had any difficulty in doing so. His masterful handling of the 101 problems that arise daily in a concern like the Mammoth Publishing Company was a byword in Fleet Street. But as he sat contemplating the dilemma, on the horns of which the Duke's parting words had impaled him, he was finding it impossible to determine what course to pursue. The yearning to enroll the Empress under his banner was very powerful, but so also was his ingrained dislike for parting with large sums of money. There was, and always had been, something about signing his name to substantial checks that gave him a sort of faint feeling. He was still weighing this against that and balancing the pros and cons when a shadow fell on the sunlit turf before him, and he became aware that his reverie had been intruded on. Something female was standing beside the rustic table, and after blinking once or twice, he recognized his former secretary, Lavender Briggs. She was regarding him austerely through her harlequin glasses. If Lavender Briggs's gaze was austere, it had every reason for being so. No girl enjoys hearing herself described as tall and ungainly, with large feet and hair like seaweed, especially if the description is followed up by the revelation that the 500 golden pounds on which she had been counting to start her off as a proprietress of a typewriting bureau have gone with the wind, never to return. If she'd not had a business proposition to place before him, she wouldn't have lowered herself by exchanging words with this man. She would much have preferred to hit him on the head with the tankard from which the Duke had been refreshing himself. But a business girl cannot choose her associates. She has to take them as they come.
"Good afternoon, Lord Tilbury," she said coldly. "If you could spare me a moment of your time."
To any other caller, without an appointment, the owner of the Mammoth Publishing Company would have been brusque. But Lord Tilbury couldn't forget that this was the girl who had come within an ace of taking £500 off the Duke of Dunstable. And feeling as he did about the Duke, he found his surprise at seeing her mingled with an unwilling respect. It would be too much to say that he was glad to see her, for he had hoped to continue wrestling undisturbed with the problem which was exercising his mind. But if she wanted a moment of his time, she could certainly have it. He even went so far as to ask her to take a seat, which she did. And having done so, she came, like a good businesswoman, straight to the point.
"I heard what the Duke of Dunstable was saying to you," she said. "This matter of Lord Emsworth's pig. His demand for £3,000 was preposterous, quite absurd. Do not dream of yielding to his terms."
Lord Tilbury found himself warming to this girl. He still felt that the words in which he had described her hair, feet, and general appearance had been well chosen, but we cannot all be Miss Americas, and he was prepared to condone her physical defects in consideration of this womanly sympathy. Beauty, after all, is but skin deep. The main thing a man should ask of the other sex is that their hearts be in the right place, as hers was. Preposterous, quite absurd, the very expressions he would have chosen himself. On the other hand, it seemed to him that she was overlooking something.
"But I want that pig. You shall have it."
Enlightenment dawned on Lord Tilbury.
"Why, of course. You mean you'll,
purloin it for you? Quite. My arrangements are all made, and can be put into effect immediately."
Lord Tilbury could recognize efficiency when he saw it. Here, he perceived, was a girl who thought on her feet and did it now. A genial glow suffused him. Almost as sweet as the thought of obtaining possession of the Empress was the knowledge that, to employ the latter's phrase, he would be putting one over on the Duke.
"Provided,"
Lavender Briggs went on,
"that we agree on terms. I should require £500.
Later, you mean?
Now, I mean. I know you always carry your checkbook with you.
Lord Tilbury gulped. Then the momentary sensation of nausea passed. Nothing could make him enjoy writing a cheque for £500, but there are times when a man has to set his teeth and face the facts of life.
Very well,
he said a little huskily.
Thank you,
said Lavender Briggs a few moments later, placing the slip of paper in her bag.
And now I ought to be getting back to the castle. Lady Constance may be wanting me for something. I will go and telephone for the station cab.
The telephone, by means of which residents of the Emsworth Arms put themselves in touch with the station cab, John Robinson, proprietor, was in the bar. Proceeding thither, Lavender Briggs was about to go in when she nearly collided with Lord Ickenham coming out. Lord Ickenham had come to the bar of the Emsworth Arms because the warmth of the day had made him want to renew his acquaintance with G. Oven's home brew, of which he had many pleasant memories. It would have been possible, indeed, it would have been more seemly, for him to have taken tea on the terrace with Lady Constance. But he was a kindly man, and something told him that after their recent get-together, his hostess would prefer to be spared anything in the nature of peaceful coexistence with him. Moments come in a woman's life, he knew, when her prime need is a complete absence of Ickenham's. He was glad to see Lavender Briggs. He was a man who made friends easily, and in the course of his visit to the castle, something approaching a friendship had sprung up between himself and her. And though he disapproved of her recent activities, he could understand and sympathise with the motives which had actuated them. He was a broad-minded man, and it was his opinion that a girl who needs £500 to set herself up in business for herself is entitled to stretch a point or two, and to forget, if only temporarily, the lessons which he learned at her mother's knee. Thinking these charitable thoughts, and knowing the reception that awaited her at Blandings Castle, he was happy to have this opportunity of warning her against completing her journey there.
"Well, well," he said. "So, you're back?"
"Yes. I caught the 12:30 train."
"I wonder how it compares with the 2:15.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Just a random thought. It was simply that I have heard the 2:15 rather highly spoken of lately. Did you have a nice time in London?"
"Quite enjoyable, thank you."
"I hope I didn't stop you going into that bar for a quick one."
"I was merely intending to telephone for the station cab to take me to the castle."
"I see. Well, I wouldn't. Are you familiar with the poem Excelsior?"
"I read it as a child,"
said Lavender Briggs, with a little shiver of distaste. She did not admire Longfellow.
"Then you'll recall what the old man said to the fellow with the banner with the strange device. Try not the pass, he said. Dark lowers the tempest overhead. That is what an old, or rather elderly, but wonderfully well-preserved, man is saying to you now. Avoid station cabs. Lay off them. Leave them alone. You are better without them."
"I don't know what you mean."
"There are many things you do not know, Miss Briggs,"
said Lord Ickenham gravely,
"including the fact that you have got a large smut on your nose."
"Oh, have I?"
said Lavender Briggs, opening her bag in a flutter and reaching hurriedly for her mirror. She plied the cleansing tissue.
"Is that better?"
"Practically perfect. I wish I could say as much for your general position."
"I don't understand."
"You will. You're in the soup, Miss Briggs. The gaff has been blown, and the jig is up. The pitiless light of day has been thrown on your pig purloining plans. Bill Bailey has told all."
"What?"
"Yes, he has squealed to the FBI. Where you made your mistake was in underestimating his integrity. These curates have scruples. The Reverend Cuthbert Baileys are the talk of Bottleton East. Your proposition revolted him, and only the fact that you didn't offer him any kept him from spurning your gold. He went straight to Lord Emsworth and came clean. That is why I suggest that you do not telephone for station cabs in that light-hearted way. John Robinson would take you to your destination for a reasonably modest sum, no doubt, but what would you find there on arrival? A Lord Emsworth, with all his passions roused and flame coming out of both nostrils. For don't deceive yourself into thinking that he will be waiting on the front doorstep with a welcome to Blandings Castle on his lips. In his current role of saber-toothed tiger, he would probably bite several pieces out of your leg. I have seldom seen a man who has got it so thoroughly up his nose.
Lavender Briggs's jaw had fallen. So, slipping from between her nerveless fingers, had her bag. It fell to earth, and from it there spilled a powder compact, a handkerchief, a comb, a lipstick, a matchbox, an eyebrow pencil, a wallet with a few pound notes in it, a small purse containing some shillings, a bottle of digestive pills, a paperback copy of a book by Alfred Camus, and the Tilbury check. A little breeze which had sprung up sent the last named fluttering across the road, with Lord Ickenham in agile pursuit. He recovered it, glanced at it, and brought it back to her, his eyebrows raised.
"Your tariff for stealing pigs comes high," he said. "Who's Tilbury? Anything to do with Tilbury House?"
There was good stuff in Lavender Briggs. Where a lesser woman would have broken down and wept, she merely hitched up her fallen jaw and tightened her lips.
"He owns it," she said, taking the check. "I used to be his secretary. Lord Tilbury."
"Oh, that chap. Good heavens. What are you doing?"
"I'm tearing up his check."
Lord Ickenham stopped her with a horrified gesture.
"But, my dear child, you mustn't dream of doing such a thing. You need it in your business."
"But I can't take his money now."
"Of course you can. Stick to it like glue. He has far too much money anyway, and it's very bad for him. Look on adhering to this 500 as a kindly act in his best interests, designed to make him a better, deeper man. It may prove a turning point in his life. I would take £500 off Tilbury myself, if only I could think of a way of doing it. I should feel it was my duty. But if you have scruples, though you haven't any business having any, not being a curate, look on it as a loan. You could even pay him interest. Not too much, of course. You don't want to spoil him. I would suggest a yearly fiver, accompanied, as a pretty gesture, by a bunch of white violets. But you can think that over at your leisure. The problem that presents itself now, it seems to me, is where do you go from here? I take it that you will wish to return to London, but you don't want another stuffy journey in the train. I'll tell you what," said Lord Ickenham, inspired. "We'll hire a car. I'll pay for it, and you can reimburse me when that typewriting bureau of yours gets going. Don't forget the bunch of white violets."
"Oh, Lord Ickenham,"
said Lavender Briggs devoutly.
"What a help you are."
"Help is a thing I'm always glad to be of,"
said Lord Ickenham in his courteous way. As he turned from waving a genial hand at the departing car and set out on the 2-mile walk back to the castle, Lord Ickenham was feeling the gentle glow of satisfaction, which comes to a man of goodwill, conscious of having acted for the best. There had been a moment when his guardian angel, who liked him to draw the line somewhere, had shown a disposition to become critical of his recent activities, whispering in his ear that he ought not to have abetted Lavender Briggs in what, in the guardian angel's opinion, was pretty raw work, and virtually tantamount to robbery from the person. But he had his answer ready. Lavender Briggs, he replied in rebuttal, needed the stuff, and when you find a hard-up girl who needs the stuff, the essential thing is to see that she gets it, and not be fussy about the methods employed to that end. This, moreover, he pointed out, was a special case. As he had reminded La Briggs, It was imperative for the good of his soul that Lord Tilbury should receive an occasional punch in the bank balance, and to have neglected this opportunity of encouraging his spiritual growth would have been mistaken kindness. His guardian angel, who could follow a piece of reasoning all right if you explained it carefully to him, apologized and said he hadn't thought of that. "Forget the whole thing," the guardian angel said. With the approach of evening, the day had lost much of its oppressive warmth. But Lord Ickenham kept his walking pace down to a quiet amble, strolling in leisurely fashion and pausing from time to time to inspect the local flora and fauna. And he had stopped to exchange a friendly glance with a rabbit, whose looks he liked, when he became aware that there were others more in tune than himself with the modern spirit of rush and bustle. Running footsteps sounded from behind him, and a voice was calling his name. Turning, he saw that the Duke of Dunstable's nephew, Archie Gilpin, was approaching him at a high rate of MPH. With Archie's brother, Ricky, the poet who supplemented the meagre earnings of a minor bard by selling onion soup in a bar off Leicester Square, Lord Ickenham had long been acquainted. But Archie, except for seeing him at meals, he scarcely knew. Nevertheless, he greeted him with a cordial smile. The urgency of his manner suggested that here was another fellow human being in need of his advice and counsel, and, as always, he was delighted to give it. His services were never confined to close personal friends.
"Hello there," he said. "Getting into training for the village sports?"
Archie came to a halt, panting. He was a singularly handsome young man. Pongo at the Milton Street Registry Office had described him as good-looking, but Lord Ickenham, now that he had met him, considered this an understatement. Tall and slim and elegant, he looked like a film star of the better type. He also, Lord Ickenham was sorry to see, looked worried, and he prepared to do all that was in his power to brighten life for him. Archie seemed embarrassed. He ran a hand through his hair, which was longer than Lord Ickenham liked hair to be. A visit to a hairdresser would, in his opinion, have done this Gilpin a world of good. But artists, he reminded himself, are traditionally shy of the scissors, and to do the lad justice, he did not wear sideburns.
"I say," said Archie, when he'd finished panting, "could you spare me a moment?" "Dozens, my dear fellow. Help yourself." "I don't want to interrupt you if you're thinking about something." "I'm always thinking about something, but I can switch it off in a second, just like that. What seems to be the trouble?" "Well, I'm in a bit of a jam, and my brother Ricky once told me that if ever I got into a jam of any kind, you were the man to get me out of it. When it comes to fixing things, he said, you have to be seen to be believed."
Lord Ickenham was gratified, as any man would have been. One always likes a word of praise from the fans.
"He probably had in mind the time when I was instrumental in getting him the money that enabled him to buy that onion soup bar of his. Oddly enough, it was not till I'd had it explained to me by my nephew Pongo that I knew what an onion soup bar was. My life is lived in the country, and we rustics so soon get out of touch. Pongo tells me these bars abound in the Piccadilly Circus and Leicester Square neighbourhoods of London, staying open all night and selling onion soup to the survivors of bottle parties. It sounds the ideal life. Is Ricky still gainfully employed in that line?"
Rather. But may I tell you about my jam?"
Lord Ickenham clicked an apologetic tongue.
"Of course, yes, I'm sorry. I'm afraid we old gaffers from the country have a tendency to ramble on. When I start talking, you must stop me, even if you haven't heard it before. This jam of yours, you were saying, not a bad jam, I trust?"
Once more, Archie Gilpin ran a hand through his hair. The impression he conveyed was that if the vultures gnawing at his bosom did not shortly change their act, he would begin pulling it out in handfuls.
"It's the dickens of a jam. I don't know what to do about it.
Have you ever been engaged to two girls at the same time?
Not to my recollection. Nor, now I come to think of it, do I know of anyone who has. Except, of course, King Solomon and the late Brigham Young.
Well, that's what I am.
You engaged to two girls? Half a second, let me work this out.
There was a pause, during which Lord Ickenham seemed to be doing sums in his head.
No,
he said at length.
I don't get it. I'm aware that you are betrothed to my little friend Myra Shoemaker, but however often I tot up the score, that only makes one. You're sure you haven't slipped up somewhere in your figures?
Archie Gilpin's eye rolled in a fine frenzy, glancing from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven, though one would more readily have expected that sort of thing from his poetic brother.
Look here,
he said.
Could we sit down somewhere? This is going to take some time.
Why, certainly. There should be good sitting on that stile over there, and take all the time you want.
Seated on the stile, his deportment rather like that of a young Hindu fakir, lying for the first time on the traditional bed of spikes, Archie Gilpin seemed still to find a difficulty in clothing his thoughts in words. He cleared his throat a good deal, and once more disturbed his hair with a fevered hand. He reminded Lord Ickenham of a nervous after-dinner speaker, suddenly aware, after rising to his feet, that he has completely forgotten the story of the two Irishmen, Pat and Mike, on which he'd been relying to convulse his audience.
I don't know where to begin.
At the beginning, don't you think? I often feel that that is best. Then work through the middle, and from there, taking your time, carry on to the end.
This appeared to strike Archie Gilpin as reasonable. He became a little calmer.
Well, it started with old Tilbury. You know I had a job on one of old Tilbury's papers?
Had?
He fired me last week.
Too bad. Why was that?
He didn't like a caricature I'd drawn of him.
You shouldn't have shown it to him.
I didn't. Not exactly. I showed it to Millicent. I thought she would get a laugh out of it.
Millicent?
His secretary, Millicent Rigby, girl I was engaged to.
That you were engaged to?
Yes. She broke it off.
Of course, yes,
said Lord Ickenham.
I remember now that Pongo told me he had met a fellow who knew a chap who was acquainted with Miss Rigby, and she had told him, the chap, not the fellow, that she'd handed you the pink slip. What had you done to incur her displeasure? You showed her this caricature, you say, but why should that have offended her? Tilbury, if I follow you correctly, was its subject, not she.
A curious rumbling sound told Lord Ickenham that his companion had uttered a hollow groan. It occurred to him, as the other's hand once more shot to his head, that if this gesture was to be repeated much oftener, Archie, like Lady Constance, would have to go to Shrewsbury for a hairdo.
Yes, I know. Yes, that's right. But I ought to have mentioned that, thinking Tilbury was out at lunch, I went and showed it to her in his office. I put it on his desk, and we were looking at it with our heads together.
Ah,
said Lord Ickenham, beginning to understand.
And he wasn't out at lunch. He came back?
Yes.
Saw your handiwork?
Yes.
Took umbrage?
Yes.
And erased your name from the list of his skilled assistants?
Yes. It was his first move. And later on, Millicent ticked me off in no uncertain manner for being such a fool as to bring the thing into the old blighter's office, because anyone but a perfect idiot would have known that he was bound to come in. And hadn't I any sense at all, and... Oh, well, you know what happens when a girl starts letting a fellow have it. One word led to another, if you know what I mean.
And it wasn't long before she was breaking the engagement and telling me she didn't want to see or speak to me again in this world or the next. She didn't actually return the ring because I hadn't given her one. But apart from that, she made the thing seem pretty final.
Lord Ickenham was silent for a moment. He was thinking of the 6 times his Jane had done the same thing by him years ago, and he knew how the other must be feeling.
"I see," he said. "Well, my heart bleeds for you, my poor young piece of human wreckage. But this bears out what I was saying, that the sum total of your fiancés is not 2, but 1. It's nice to have got that straight."
Another hollow groan escaped Archie Gilpin. His hand rose, but Lord Ickenham caught it in time.
"I wouldn't," he said. "Don't touch it. It looks lovely."
"But you don't know what happened just now. You could have knocked me down with a toothpick. I was coming along by the Emsworth Arms, and I saw her."
"Miss Rigby?"
"Yes."
"Probably a mirage."
"No. She was there in the flesh."
"What in the world was she doing in Market Blandings?"
"Apparently old Tilbury came here for some reason."
Lord Ickenham nodded. He knew that reason.
"And he brought her with him to do his letters. She'd popped out for a breath of air, and I came along, and we met, face to face, just about opposite the Jubilee Memorial watering trough in the High Street."
"Dramatic."
"I was never so surprised in my life."
"I can readily imagine it. Was she cold and proud and aloof?"
"Not by a jugful. She was all over me. Remorse had set in. She said she was sorry she had blown a fuse and wept a good deal and, well, there we were, so to speak."
"You folded her in your embrace, no doubt?"
"Yes. Quite a good deal, actually. And the upshot of the whole thing was that we got engaged again."
"You didn't mention that you were engaged to Myra."
"No, I didn't get around to that. The subject didn't seem to come up somehow."
"I quite understand. So the total is 2, after all." "You were perfectly right, and I apologize." "Well, well.
I don't see what you're grinning about."
"Smiling gently would be a more exact description. I was thinking how absurdly simple these problems are, when you give your mind to them. The solution here is obvious. You must at once tell Myra to make no move in the way of buying the trousseau and pricing wedding cakes, because they won't be needed."
Only a sudden clutch at the rail on which he was seated prevented Archie Gilpin from falling off the stile. It seemed for a moment that he was about to reach for his hair again, but he merely gaped like a good-looking codfish.
"Tell her it's all off, you mean?"
"Precisely. Save the girl a lot of unnecessary expense."
"But I can't. I admit that I asked her to marry me because I was feeling pretty bitter about Millicent, and had some sort of rough idea of showing her
that she was not the only onion in the stew?"
"Something on those lines. And I was considerably relieved when she turned me down. A narrow escape, I felt I'd had. But now that, on second thoughts, she's decided that she's in favour of the scheme, I don't see how I can possibly just stroll in and tell her I've changed my mind. Well, dash it. Is a shot like that on the board, I ask you?"
"You mean, once a Gilpin plights his troth, it stays plighted?" "A very creditable attitude to take, though it's a pity you plight it so often. But if you're thinking you may break that gentle heart, have no uneasiness. I can state authoritatively that, left to herself, she wouldn't marry you with a 10-foot pole."
"Then why did she tell me she would?"
"For precisely the reason that made you propose to her. Relations were strained between her and her betrothed, just as they were between you and Miss Rigby. And she did it as what is known as a gesture. She thought, in a word, that that would teach him."
"She's got a betrothed?"
"And how? You know him, my friend Merriweather."
"Good Lord!"
Archie Gilpin seemed to blossom like a rose in June.
Well, this is fine. You've eased my mind.
A pleasure.
Now one begins to see daylight. Now one knows where one is. But look here, we don't want to do anything... what's the word?
Precipitate?
Yes, we want to move cautiously. You see, on the strength of getting engaged to the daughter of a millionaire, I'm hoping to extract £1,000 from Uncle Alaric.
Lord Ickenham pursed his lips.
From His Grace the Pop-Eyed Duke of Dunstable? No easy task. His one-way pockets are a byword all over England.
Archie nodded. He'd never blinded himself to the fact that anyone trying to separate cash from the Duke of Dunstable was in much the same position as a man endeavouring to take a bone from a short-tempered wolfhound.
I know, but I have a feeling it will come off. When I told him I was engaged to Myra, he was practically civil. I think he's ripe for the touch, and I've simply got to get £1,000.
Why that particular sum?
Because that's what Ricky wants. To let me into his onion soup business. He's planning to expand and has to have more capital. He said that if I put in £1,000, I could have a third share of the profits, which are enormous.
Yes, so Pongo told me. I got the impression of dense crowds of bottle party addicts charging into Ricky's bar night after night like bisons making for a waterhole.
That's right, they do. There's something about onion soup that seems to draw them like a magnet. Can't stand the muck myself, but there's no accounting for taste. Here's the setup as I see it, said Archie, with mounting enthusiasm. We coast along as we are at present. Myra engaged to me, me engaged to Myra, and Uncle Alaric fawning on me and telling me I can have anything I want, even unto half his kingdom. I get £1,000. Myra gives me the push. I slide off and marry Millicent. Myra marries this Merryweather chap, and everybody's happy. Any questions?
A look of regret and pity had come into Lord Ickenham's face. It pained him to be compelled to act as a black frost in this young man's garden of dreams. But he had no alternative.
Myra can't give you the push.
Archie stared. It seemed to him that this kindly old buster, until now so intelligent, had suddenly lost his grip.
Why not?
Because the moment she did, she would be shipped back to America in disgrace and would never see Bill Bailey again.
Who on earth's Bill Bailey?
Oh, I forgot to tell you, didn't I? That, or rather, the Reverend Cuthbert Bailey, is Merryweather's real name. He's here incognito because Lady Constance has a deep-seated prejudice against him. He is a penniless curate, and she doesn't like penniless curates. It was to remove Myra from his orbit that she took her away from London and imprisoned her at Blandings Castle. Let her break the engagement, and she'll be back in New York before you can say what ho.
Silence fell. The light had faded from the evening sky and simultaneously from Archie Gilpin's face. He sat staring bleakly into the middle distance, as if the scenery hurt him in some tender spot.
It's a mix-up, he said.
It wants thinking about,
Lord Ickenham agreed.
Yes, it certainly wants thinking about. We must turn it over in our minds from time to time.